From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
Arkansas is one step closer to perhaps getting its first dental college.
State lawmakers try to understand the ins and outs of schools in academic distress.
A high-profile murder trial begins in Little Rock.
A memorial service for former Senator and Arkansas Governor Dale Bumpers.
I'm Michael Heplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Those stories are coming up on KUAR's Weekend Review podcast. Well, Jacob, a lot of people may not realize that Arkansas doesn't actually have a college where people can become a dentist. All of the dentists we have in the state have to leave the state, go elsewhere to actually graduate. But this week, the Legislative Council Review Subcommittee approved a contract studying at least the viability of Arkansas getting its first dental school.
That's right. And UAMS officials told state lawmakers that most of Arkansas's dentists ended up going to school in Tennessee. And they said the one problem with that is that they have to pay out-of-state tuition. So if you want to pursue that course of education, you're in Arkansas, you have to pay $70,000 a year versus $40,000 a year. So it said that's an educational barrier, one. And number two, this is the provost, Stephanie Garner, explaining kind of her primary reason is simply that Arkansas, as a result, she concludes, as a result of not having the dental college, it helps give us one of the worst dental rankings in terms of oral health.
There are, as of now, less dentists per capita in Arkansas than in any other state currently. We also know that there are several counties in Arkansas that do not have a dentist.
And so UAMS originally asked for over $600,000 from the legislature of their own to be used for this kind of study of the dental school. It was reduced all the way down to $48,000. And the reason why was originally they presented this to the full legislative council, and they wanted every phase of the study completed up through developing curriculum to accreditation. There was some concern from legislators at that full committee meeting, so they re-referred it back to this subcommittee that you mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast. And all of this would be, it's important to note, for this first phase would be funded entirely by Delta Dental, who maybe they could stand to make some money out of this, is why they might be funding this. But Provost Garner says that no matter what, they're going to follow what the study says. If it's feasible, it's feasible. If it's not, they're not going to try anymore.
I think this is it's the time to evaluate this. The amount is less than $50,000 for the first phase, and we would not move to another phase if the consultant said it's not possible.
And this consultants, it's an Atlanta-based company. Stephanie Garner said in the last 3 years they've evaluated 4 dental college feasibility studies in different states, and they've approved 2 of them. So not 100% right there. It's not a guarantee that just because they got the consultants, they're going to confirm what they want. And whatever the if this is approved, this contract, it goes back to the full legislative council. It'll take about 6 months or so to get the results of this consultant study. Senator Joyce Elliott, she said that while it is important to train doctors and to train dentists, if the state's going to invest that money in it, she wants to make sure that dentists will go to areas that don't get a lot of service right now. And Senator Missy Irvin of Mountain View, in the same committee hearing, she's from a more rural setting than Joyce Elliott anyway. She agreed with that, and she said she agreed with it, but she also took some time to kind of criticize UAMS for not doing that more in existing programs.
UAMS has detoured away from that with a rural residency program being not existent. So, you know, I hear your argument for that, which I would agree with, but you abandoned it when it came to medical school and residency. So, you know, I just would appreciate consistency there because I think there's value there. I think it's really important, and we talk about that a lot. We need to have, and exactly what you said is exactly the truth, which is if people go out and practice in those areas, and they're more likely to move there. However, that philosophy should be shared across your spectrum of all professions, not just dental. I think it needs to be across the board.
And so UAMS mentioned one example of a school that they've been looking at, East Carolina University in North Carolina, that in their year for their dental students, their final year, they have to spend at least 24 weeks in some sort of rural clinic or residency program.
And what would be the next phase in this if lawmakers do end up going along with this after this study comes out?
After the study comes out, well, they described that they could do this in three or four different phases. So the first would be to find out if it's feasible or not. And the second step, especially if lawmakers really want this rural residency program, which UAMS said that they're also strongly considering, that they would then go forward and identify different clinics that dental students could train at. They said that could take up to 2 or 4 years.
Well, Sarah, another legislative matter this week that really has lawmakers sharply divided, looking at the causes as well as possible solutions for schools that are in academic distress. And of course, this is, you know, what caused Little Rock to end up having its district taken over by the state school board, dissolved because of 6 schools in academic distress there. Tell me about this hearing and what has lawmakers concerned.
Well, Michael, these decisions about academic distress come up periodically. Their fiscal distress status after 5 years, there's a possibility of a review of whether or not the state control should be returned to the local board. And so community members are having a forum tonight, and that'll go before
Worth
the
Worth noting
state board.
We're recording this on Thursday.
All right. But anyway, we know that academic distress is measured by this 49.5 mark. If students score proficiency below that level for 3 years continuously, the school can be determined to be in academic distress. It's a relatively new rule, about 2 years old, and that means that the state then has a reason to take over either an entire district or potentially several schools. So this has been happening across the state. And this week, the Education Caucus met with Department of Education staff just to get an explainer on the ins and outs of what is academic distress. I guess in a general sense, so the lawmakers would understand that category a bit better, because it seems that there's no real clear criteria for those takeover decisions. And so coming into the fiscal session, it was a rather wide-ranging conversation. But from what I can make of it, there seems to be two general approaches. John Walker, representing the longstanding interests of the African-American community in desegregation matters and a longstanding federal case, says that he thinks that academic distress categories are really a instrument to resegregate the whole state school system. So I asked him about that.
Well, obviously it's race. If you look at the schools that they have in academic distress, every one of them is majority black, and every one of them has huge fiscal issues. And one way you avoid addressing the fiscal issues is by taking the school over by whatever pretext you call it. You don't fix up the building, you don't have to deal with facilities, you don't have to deal with resources, and then you just say, well, these kids are not learning, so we need to go ahead and combine them or put them in something else. And so that's another form, that's a modern form of slavery.
Representative Walker actually ended up getting up and walking out of the caucus meeting because while this general discussion of distress was going on, he started asking questions, and then the chair and various other members of the committee were frustrated that it seemed like he was wanting to discuss his ongoing lawsuit against the district, which is about constitutional issues of inequity that he's claiming. And Republican Representative Mark Lowry and various others were saying that they disagreed that this facility's inequities were a cause of the distress problem, that the problem was harder to trace from, inadequate schools, poverty, lack of funding. And so Representative Lowry asked Education Commissioner Johnny Key what his take on distress was and how the state actually measures it.
We have all kinds of data that we collect, and districts vary in their ability to analyze and take that analysis and put it into action in a classroom. And that's something that as an agency we're looking at to see, okay, how can we become more student focused, knowing that we still have federal accountability that requires 95% testing under the new federal law, still requires looking in the aggregate, but breaking that down not just into the subcomponents by race, by poverty, and all those typical subcomponents that are part of the assessment system and the accountability system. But how do we get down to that individual student, and what supports can we as a state and districts give to teachers to help drive that improvement for that one student of that 30%? And I know that sounds daunting, but I think we're more and more the evidence is pointing to the fact that, you know, a child may not need 9 months to get to advance a grade level. That child may need 5 months, but his neighbor may need 11 months to advance. And you see, like Warren, who has established a charter school where they're looking at competency-based, where students are more able to move at their own pace. The students that need a little more help get that focused help. So I think those are the efforts that we need to make, and see how our statutory provisions line up to enable districts to make those changes, not necessarily policy changes, but giving them the flexibility to make those internal changes to match the needs of their school district.
So sounds a little obtuse to me, but what I'm interpreting to the best of my ability here is that if there were two camps looking at the same problem of distress, one might say what we need is flexibility. Commissioner Key mentioned charter schools. The Walton Family Foundation is funding a new slate of charter schools in the state, and various public schools are getting waivers to operate with some requirements, less requirements. It seems that Commissioner Key is in support of that approach to shifting education. And then you have the John Walker saying that the systemic inequities are this type of flexibility in input of state control is just leading to segregation, and it's a pretense. So I don't know if we're more confused than we started, but.
Well, and we also had Baker Curris, who is now leading the Little Rock School District.
I also wanted to ask about Baker Curris a little bit. Did I hear that right, that you said that Mark Lowry was kind of arguing that facilities weren't a cause of academic distress, and then here we have the Little Rock School District embarking on building new schools?
Yeah, there was a back and forth. Mark Lowry was saying there's no proof that facilities are a cause of distress. They might be related, and various other members of that education caucus spoke up and said, perhaps, but poor school districts' performance certainly is impacted by distress, by poor facilities. And Baker Curris is critically emphasizing his strategy for the district is to start with building a new middle school in West Little Rock, and then shutting down some smaller schools that are in poor condition around the district, and as he called it, leapfrogging forward. So starting one step at a time to build slowly this world-class facilities in the district, and then when he's got renewed interest, students coming back into the district because it's more competitive with the private schools that are surrounding it, he will then go back and ask for a millage increase, and he hopes that hundreds of millions of dollars could be raised just by that sort of renewed interest. And he says that's what's happening in Jacksonville now, that they've separated from the PCSSD, that they'll actually be asking for a higher millage than Little Rock currently does, and that he'd like to have the same ability here.
You mentioned that Curris floated the idea of a millage increase for the school district. Did he indicate when they might push for that?
I don't think anytime soon, because he was saying first he's going to build these various schools, and it's sort of a down the road aspiration that he could build enough community support that there would be voters willing to put their money down because they've brought their kids back to the district. So I think it's more of a long-term aspiration. And of course, the context of part of this is that the school district has to replace the $40 million it's losing in the next school year because of the end of the desegregation lawsuit.
And of course, as Curris and as we had on our podcast a week or so ago, Curris says that he hopes this will help bring back enrollment, bring kids back to neighborhood schools who are going to charter schools or elsewhere.
If you read histories of the school district after the desegregation era, there was school busing when neighborhoods became more segregated. There was school busing to counteract the effect of those segregated neighborhoods. And then according to our local historian here, John Kirk, he says that with school busing, then there was the rise of private schools. And that's when many white students or students of upper classes just left the district entirely. So this is playing out again and again, but Baker Kirst wants to attract some of those numbers of students back into the West Little Rock neighborhoods that it's hard to retain the residents there to stay in the district.
Well, right now we have, as we record this on Thursday, one of the biggest high-profile trials maybe in a couple of years underway. A murder trial that was about a year and a half ago that a real estate agent named Beverly Carter went missing. Police said she had gone to a home in the town of Scott, just outside of Little Rock, to show a house that was for sale, and then was missing for several days. She had a big, intense search, and eventually a body was found, and a suspect was arrested. The body was found at a concrete plant where Aaron Lewis, the suspect, had once worked. And police said they took evidence from texts and phone calls and believed that Aaron had set up Carter. Prosecutors saying that she went to the home and that he then took her, hoping to get ransom money for her. But this is playing out, and as we record this on Thursday, it's the second day of witnesses taking the stand. But we spoke with Janelle Lilly of our content partner at KATV Channel 7, who covered opening statements. We can't bring you the audio of opening statements. It's typically not allowed in state court, so we often have to rely on the accounts of other reporters. But she shared first what the prosecution said. And you'll hear extremely different beliefs as presented between the prosecution and defense about what actually happened here and whether or not Aaron Lewis is indeed the one who killed Beverly Carter. But first, here is Lily talking about the prosecutor's opening statement.
The prosecution began the opening statements by kind of giving a bio of who Beverly Carter was. They talked about her success in real estate. They talked about her life as a family woman, the children that she had, and then they segued into the last day of her life and how terrifying it would have been to be shoved into a vehicle and to be told that this was going to be a bad day for you, to be held at taser. And they went through what they believe were the last hours of her life, the events leading up to her eventual death. They talked about her being locked in a bathroom for several hours, being duct taped, and then they eventually talked about how they believe she died, which it was a quite graphic statement, but they said her whole head was duct taped six times around, and she ended up suffocating to death. They then went on to recap what they believe happened to her body post-mortem, being buried in a shallow grave. It was very graphic for sure. They also laid out what their strategy was going to be. They said there were five areas that they wanted the jury to pay attention to. That was her notebook that she had written in. They wanted the jury to pay attention to the electronic evidence, the text messages, the phone calls, even the emails between Beverly Carter and Aaron Lewis. And then the ransom message, which was recorded on Aaron Lewis's phone. They want the jury to pay attention to that. The statements that he made to both the press and to the police officers at the time, and then also the testimony of Crystal Lowry, his wife. They kind of laid out their case in those five tiers and asked the jury to pay special attention to all the evidence that revolved around those.
And Crystal Lowry, the former wife of suspect Aaron Lewis, who is cooperating with the investigation, pleaded guilty, and is expected to be a key witness during the trial. But defense attorney Bill James had a very different story for the jurors and even suggested that Carter died during a sexual tryst gone wrong, as he put it. Again, Chanel Lilly from KATV Channel 7.
He started off by framing the argument in the sense that everybody has two lives, the lives they live by day and the lives they live by night. And he used a quote from actually a police officer who said that everyone has a second life that others don't know about. He framed all of the people in this with two lives. He talked about Crystal Lowry having a life during the day as a mom and as a nursing student, but at night he called her, quote, a prostitute. And he talked about Beverly Carter. He said that the life that the prosecution laid out for her as a happy wife, as a successful real estate agent, wasn't true, that she and her husband had been having marital problems, that they she had had an unsuccessful year as a real estate agent and was 3 months behind on her mortgage. He also spoke often about some surgeries that she had, a breast augmentation and a tummy tuck, and then also the purchase of a new Cadillac, and said all three of those are decisions that someone who was making rational decisions on a budget that she was on, not being in a successful year, would not have made. He said that she was not making rational decisions at that time. And then he talked about Aaron Lewis, and he said, you know, the life that Crystal would have said that he would was leading at the time, you know, a stay-at-home husband. And she was aware, and he was aware of both of their affinities for hooking up, was the quote, with other people. But he said that he was also a dad who stayed at home and helped around the house. So he really phrased it in a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde for each one of the characters in the story.
So very different accounts there presented between the prosecution and defense. And we'll see what happens with this trial. Well, finally this week, Chris, family, friends, and colleagues of former Senator and Arkansas Governor Dale Bumpers gathered for a memorial service. That was on Sunday. We talked quite a bit about Bumpers on last week's podcast, heard an interview that the senator had recorded with KUAR back in 2003, and heard his longtime colleague, David Pryor, also share some stories. But this week we had one veteran journalist who shared several stories along with former President Clinton.
Yeah, they eulogized at the service with Pryor at First United Methodist Church in downtown Little Rock. And I won't rehash too much of Bumper's legacy. We touched on quite a lot of that last week. But Ernie Dumas, who's been in Arkansas covering politics since the early 1960s, first for the Gazette and later as a columnist, and now works for the Arkansas Times. He also did a sprawling, like, 10-hour oral history with Bumpers when he was still alive. Shared a lot of stories on the political trail, talked about just Bumpers' general style, especially during his first run for governor in 1970, when he defeated both Orville Faubus in a runoff primary and Winthrop Rockefeller, the Republican who had been elected a few years earlier, who had defeated Faubus, two kind of giants of Arkansas politics who had, you know, of course, have a mixed reputation of their own. But Dumas, he talked a lot about Bumper's kind of honest, forthright delivery when he talked to voters on the campaign trail, and also how he was able to mix his renowned sort of witticisms with appealing to voters. So here's one story he shared that kind of illustrates this style of Bumper's.
During that first race, Faubus held a press conference at Little Rock in the runoff, where he revealed that because a lot of people wanted so badly to prevent his returning to office, that he had gotten intelligence that he would be dead within 6 months if he were elected. And that evening, Bumpers and Faubus shared a platform at Pine Bluff. Faubus spoke first, but he didn't mention the apparently death threat, which is what he was implying. So when Dale got up, he told them about the Faubus press conference. earlier in the day. And he said, but you have it in your power to save Orville's life. And you owe it to him. Next Tuesday, you can go to the polls and vote for me. You owe it to this man. He deserves it. You owe him a long, rich life so that he can bask in the adoration of his grandchildren. Do not forsake this man in his hour of need. Governor Faubus's campaign manager, Jack Gardner, told me the next day that Faubus came back from Pine Bluff and said, that guy is going to beat me.
So, yeah, an example of Bumper's humorous style. That 1970 race against Faubus and later with Rockefeller was the first time he had ever ran for statewide office. He had tried unsuccessfully as a state legislative candidate in the 60s, but he was really not very well known. There was a field of eight candidates in the Democratic primary. He was able to just put his name out there and eventually got elected. And once he was elected, he was governor and was able to pass these income tax increases, which were the first income tax increases since the income tax was established in the early part of the century. And President Clinton, when he got up to speak and eulogize Bumpers, talked about this slate of bills that increased income taxes as probably one of his most enduring legacies as governor. And he framed it in a way that set the course for Arkansas state government and future governors and the economy of Arkansas that succeeded in the generations in the 70s and 80s and 90s and later on. So here's Clinton sharing a little bit of that kind of state government history.
We got all these other successors of Dale Bumpers here. In one way or another, even though we differed dramatically on many issues, what he did made what we did possible. The tax increases that he passed with 75% of the legislature seems inconceivable today, but you have to realize in the 1970s, all across the South, we wanted to modernize, we wanted to catch up. We knew we had to improve education, we knew we had to diversify our economies. And so the legislature voted for that, and he did all the great things he did. But Dale Bumpers, though a social progressive, was a fiscal conservative. And we had that, plus the Revenue Stabilization Act passed in 1948, which none of us can take any credit for, which kept us all out of trouble. So when David Pryor became governor and he fell on hard times, thanks to the revenue base and the Revenue Stabilization Act, he was able to get us through those tough times in pretty good shape. When I became governor and the court said we had to equalize school funding, thanks to the tax increases, Arkansas was already the third highest state in the country in the percentage of state funding as opposed to local property taxes going to school. And we still had the second overall lowest tax burden. So we raised the sales tax a penny, raised teacher pay, raised the standards, and we didn't have to wreck everything because of what he did. He made modern Arkansas possible. He made possible the good things that Governor Tucker and Governor Huckabee did. He made it possible with that revenue base and the Revenue Stabilization Act for Mike Beebe as governor to go through the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression without having mass layoffs, without having massive cutbacks in services, without getting in all the pension trouble that all these other states are in. And Governor Hutchinson, you said a very good thing about Dale Bumpers in describing your campaign against him. Tonight you can say, he even left me the money to cut taxes. But not so much as to cause a deficit, weaken the pension funds, and undermine the future of the state.
So, yeah, that was one of the main points by Clinton. Clinton also touched on, you know, the famous impeachment trial speech that Bumpers gave in his defense, talked about how he went line by line and the provision of the Constitution in question, and showed, you know, how Bumpers was able to combine humor and logic and was able to impart information in a way that few politicians were able to do in his day. And Bumpers had a memorial service, on Sunday, and later that the next day had one in Charleston, where he's buried.
His hometown, up in West Arkansas, near Fort Smith.
While we're on the funeral march, unfortunately, I just learned on my email that former Arkansas Chief Justice Jim Hanna passed away.
It's been a rough few weeks for the state. This, as we record the program on Thursday, heading into the holiday weekend for Martin Luther King Day on Monday. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
KUAR is an editorially independent service of the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, supported by listeners like you. You can find us online at kuar.org. Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening.